From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. In his new book, The Unconquerable World, Jonathan Schell argues that war is futile, and he examines the strengths and weaknesses of the systems that were designed to prevent war, like the League of Nations and the United Nations. On today's Fresh Air, we talk with Schell about preventing wars and the use of force in U.S. foreign policy. Also, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the language wars. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. Four more prominent members of Saddam Hussein's former government are now in U.S. custody, NPR's Scott Horsley reports.
The latest members of Saddam's government to fall into U.S. hands include Muzahim Sahab Hassan al-Tikriti, the Iraqi Air Defense Commander. As number 10 on a list of Iraq's most wanted, Hassan is the highest-ranking leader caught so far. He's the Queen of Diamonds in the custom deck of playing cards that features the pictures of most wanted regime leaders. U.S. forces also have custody of Iraq's former military intelligence director and the trade minister. The two men rank 21st and 48th on the most wanted list. Separately, U.S. Special Operations Forces captured Salim Saeed Khalaf al-Jumaili during a raid in Baghdad. Jumaili was the head of the Iraqi intelligence agency's American desk. While he's not on the most wanted list, he's suspected of having knowledge of possible Iraqi spies in the United States. Scott Horsley, NPR News, Washington.
Customs officials say members of the news media and at least one American serviceman are being investigated for attempting to take illegal souvenirs from Iraq. A former TV engineer for Fox News has been charged with smuggling stolen Iraqi paintings and government bonds into the U.S. Officials say they've seized at least 15 paintings from Iraqi palaces, gold-plated guns, ornamental knives, and other items at U.S. airports. The customs commissioner says the seizure should be a warning to anyone who tries to take advantage of the current situation in Iraq. Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and his prime minister-designate have reached an agreement on the composition of a new Palestinian cabinet. The agreement paves the way for the announcement of a new U.S.-backed peace plan. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports from Jerusalem.
The agreement was announced just hours before a deadline for Prime Minister-designate Mahmoud Abbas to form his cabinet. Palestinian analysts said Yasser Arafat gave in to heavy pressure from the international community and agreed to allow former Gaza security chief Mohammed Dahlan to be in charge of security affairs. Abbas himself will be the interior minister with responsibility for the Palestinian security forces. Palestinian officials said the deal was reached after Egyptian intelligence chief Omar Suleiman mediated between Arafat and Abbas. The next step is for the Palestinian Legislative Council to approve the new government, probably early next week. President Bush has said that as soon as a new government with real authority is sworn in, he will unveil the U.S.-backed roadmap to peace. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Stock prices closed higher today on Wall Street. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained 30 points to close at 8,515 in heavy trading. Advancing issues led declines by 5 to 3. The Nasdaq gained 14 points to close at 1,466. This is NPR News. Amnesty International is denouncing the Bush administration for allegedly violating human rights by detaining juveniles among the prisoners held at the U.S. naval base in Cuba. The London-based human rights group was responding to a U.S. military spokesman at Guantanamo Bay who acknowledged that three of the prisoners are 16 or younger. The spokesman said the teenagers are being separated from the more than 600 adult prisoners at the base, all of whom are being held on suspicion of connections with Al-Qaeda or the Taliban in Afghanistan. The prisoners are being held without charge and without access to lawyers. U.S. officials have charged famed investment banker Frank Quattrone with obstruction of justice. They say he encouraged employees at Credit Suisse First Boston to destroy documents after they were subpoenaed. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
Prosecutors said Quattrone learned early in December 2000 that CS First Boston had been subpoenaed as part of an investigation into the way Wall Street firms allocated shares of stock in initial public offerings. 2 days later, they say Quattrone sent out an email essentially urging employees to purge their files of many IPO-related documents. U.S. Attorney James Comey says the charges filed against Quattrone should send a message about evidence tampering.
If you or your company get a subpoena from the SEC or the federal grand jury, do not even think about playing games with that subpoena.
Quattrone, who was one of Silicon Valley's most powerful investment bankers until his resignation last month, says he will fight the charges against him. Jim Zaroli, NPR News, New York.
And I'm Corey Flintoff, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Enterprise Florida, the economic development partnership for Florida, helping grow Florida's innovation economy. On the web at eflorida.com.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. America is the only superpower, and the U.S. military demonstrated its strength in Iraq. My guest Jonathan Schell argues that violence shouldn't be the only answer to violence. For the last 2 months, he's written cover stories for Harper's Magazine about the futility of war and the need to find peaceful alternatives to solving conflicts. These essays elaborate on the ideas in his new book, The Unconquerable World: Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. Schell is also a contributor to The Nation and has written for The New Yorker and The Atlantic. His best-known book, The Fate of the Earth, was about the likely consequences of nuclear war. In The Unconquerable World, he examines the systems designed to prevent war, starting with the League of Nations, which was established by the peace treaties that ended World War I. The main figure behind the League was President Woodrow Wilson. The League collapsed in the late 30s and was dissolved in 1946. I asked Schell about the vision behind the League of Nations.
Well, you have to remember that back at that time, you had a fully developed what I call a war system, and that consisted of many great powers jockeying for influence, rivaling one another with arms, and no one of them dared to sort of back out by having, let's say, a slower demobilization schedule or a smaller naval gun. And so it occurred to Wilson, as to many at that time, that what was necessary at that time was a full systemic replacement of the war system. It seemed to them that the World War, which had claimed about 9 million lives, had really been the product not so much of one power or another or one ideology or another as of that whole balance of power system, which had to be replaced lock, stock, and barrel. So it was a truly revolutionary proposal, a very, very tall order indeed.
Can you explain a little bit more what you mean by the war system?
Back in at the turn of the century and in 1914, 1918, you had four or five great powers, no one of which was obviously supreme. They were jockeying for advantage. They were seeking to make alliances with one another. They were trying to beat one another out in arms races. And finally, that system of a balance of power broke down and produced the First World War, whose actual substance was something incredibly minor, a very petty conflict in the Balkans in terms of, the interests of the world. But nevertheless, because it produced an imbalance, it was enough to make the whole thing collapse into a horrendous war. And it was in order to get away from that, really something, a situation that had existed more or less throughout history, many powers, very powerful, jockeying for advantage and so on. It was to get away from that really in a revolutionary bid, Wilson proposed the League of Nations, which would decide by law, by agreement, by collective security, the issues that had always previously been solved by balance of power or by war.
What was the structure that Wilson proposed for the League of Nations?
Well, he proposed that there be a council of 10 nations that would really provide collective security, which is to say that if any one nation were to mount an aggressive act, the others would band together and prevent it. So it was really a system of collective security to prevent war from ever really breaking out in the first place.
But the United States never joined.
No, the United States did not join. And it may have been that the League of Nations was unworkable in any case, but certainly it was doomed when the United States Senate voted not to become part of this plan, this vision that had been put forward to the world by its own president, President Wilson.
Why did the Senate vote against the U.S. joining the League?
Well, the senators, for one thing, they felt that it would compromise the war-making power that they had under the Constitution. They felt that it committed the United States to almost automatic, endless conflict at any time that aggression would arise anywhere in the world, and that the constitutional war-making power, which in contrast to today, they took very seriously at that time, would slip out of their hands. Perhaps more important, they shrank back from such a heavy, really what amounted to a military commitment under a collective security system to automatically join with other nations to resist or attack a country that got out of line and mounted aggression. So there was really a conflict in their minds between the Constitution of the United States and what they saw as almost a kind of surrogate constitution for the whole world that would trump the American Constitution.
So one of the reasons the League failed was that the United States, an important power, wasn't a part of it. But there were other reasons why the League failed. What are some of those reasons?
One of them was that people didn't realize it at the time, but the First World War had really been so violent that it had torn apart a number of the most important societies of the most important powers, especially the Russian and the German. And it had planted the seeds of a new system of government that was going to pose the greatest challenge to liberalism that there ever had been or ever has been, and that was the totalitarian system of government. So really, at just the time that Wilson was trying to extend peaceful liberal principles to the world at large in an incredibly ambitious program, at that very moment, the floor was sort of falling out from under his feet in those other nations, and this totalitarian threat was arising. I think that was one of the main reasons. Another was that you have to remember that the empires, the European empires of the day, and by the way, it included the recently acquired sort of mini-empire that the United States had gotten in the war with Spain, but those empires were absolutely at their peak. And the French and the British and so forth had no intention whatsoever of letting go of those. One of the key principles of the League of Nations was the self-determination of all nations. And obviously that was completely inconsistent with these imperial schemes, and the imperial schemes won out. Although Wilson's plan, of course, was a complete failure, the League was really just brushed aside by the events that followed. He was a prophet. He was a prophet because he did say that if we do not rein in this war system, if we don't replace it with something else, then we will go back to war and it will be a worse war. And that did happen in the Second World War.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Jonathan Schell. He's the author of the new book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. What was the vision that FDR and Churchill had in 1941 when they proposed the United Nations?
Well, the United Nations was really an improved version of the League of Nations. They'd seen that nations had not been able to get on the same page, that the system of collective security involving 10 or more nations really had proved unworkable. And they decided really to give the key power, the key decision-making power to a group of five, and those were the victors of the Second World War. They were the United States, the Soviet Union, France, England, and China. Now, the fate of the United Nations was actually quite different from that of the League. It was similar in that it failed to fulfill its principal function, which was to head off arms race, head off global competition, and institute a system of law or collective security. Obviously, that didn't happen. And there were really two reasons for it, and one was quite similar to what happened to the League, and that is that the group of victors fell out among themselves. Above all, the United States and the Soviet Union. So very quickly, the Cold War began to rage, and very obviously, no decision-making body that depended on agreement of the United States and the Soviet Union, as the Security Council did, was going to be able to make or keep a peace. And so the UN was, in a way, pushed to the margins of affairs, where it did all kinds of useful humanitarian things and intervened in crisis, very useful, but it couldn't fulfill its central function.
Now, the UN was conceptualized before a nuclear weapon was used, but the UN was actually created, actually came into being after Hiroshima and Nagasaki. So, as you point out in your book, the dawning of the nuclear era just preceded the United Nations. So, how was the actual world different by the time the UN came into being from the time it was conceptualized?
Well, it was radically different. And the timing there really is quite extraordinary because the plans for the UN were laid in the summer of 1945. And then late summer, on August 6th, came the bombing of Hiroshima. And then in the fall came the conference in San Francisco to actually formally set up the United Nations. So that's a very precise bit of timing. And the nuclear weapon almost immediately radically transformed the very problem that the United States had been founded to solve, which was the danger of world war. Now, it would take some time, more than a decade, for this to be played out and to be fully realized. But what happened, of course, was that the United States built a tremendous nuclear arsenal. The Soviet Union did the same. England, France got into the game, eventually China. And what happened then was that because of the incredible, actually the unlimited destructive power that was in the hands of the great powers, you couldn't fight a war anymore. I mean, you could shoot those weapons at one another and you could have blown one another up 50 times over and maybe ended life on Earth into the bargain. And we came fairly close to that a couple of times, including the Cuban Missile Crisis. But you couldn't have the kind of event that had really disfigured and shaped the whole history of the first half of the 20th century, which was a world war. You know, a tremendous slugging match among the greatest powers that would go on for 3 or 4, 5 years until someone won. That was ruled out. So in a curious way, the nuclear weapon and the nuclear standoff became a surrogate UN, if you want to put it that way. Nuclear weapons became peacekeepers.
You write in your book that because nuclear war would have ended in the annihilation of both sides, the superpowers held each other in check. But that led to a different kind of war, which you describe as a people's war, the people's war. What do you mean by that?
Well, of course, the great powers were, I mean, on the one hand, they were glad to be at peace, I suppose. But on the other hand, they were frustrated because great powers want to work their will in the world. They want to have their way. They want to make things happen. And what happened was that both went out to what they were pleased to call the periphery, that is, third world nations, where anti-colonial struggles were in progress. And above all, that meant Vietnam. So the war that could not be fought at the center erupted out there at the edges. And I think that this is a very seminal event and one that deserves our attention because it turned out that in those parts of the world, first in China, then in Vietnam, also in Algeria and other places around the world, they invented people's war. And people's war turned out to be an instrument that unexpectedly enabled poor, so-called backward peoples to hold their own against tremendous, you know, globe-straddling empires such as the United States or the Soviet Union. We saw that for the United States in Vietnam. We saw it for the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. So, for instance, if you look at the Vietnam War, it was a very strange thing happened there. I was a reporter there, so I witnessed this at first hand. And what you actually saw day after day was the United States winning battle after battle after battle after battle. I mean, 99% of the battles were being won by the United States, and yet we lost the war. Now, how could it be? The answer was that for every military battle that we won, the opponent was winning a political battle for the hearts and minds of the Vietnamese people, which meant chiefly their will, their passionate and intense will to win the independence that they'd been fighting for already for 30, 40 years against the Japanese and the French before us. So that as long as we were losing the political battle, we could not leave and put behind us and leave behind us a government that would survive our departure. Because the second we did that, the will of the local people would prevail, and they'd set up whatever kind of government they had in mind, which is, in fact, what happened.
My guest is Jonathan Schell. His new book is called The Unconquerable World. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Schell, author of the new book, The Unconquerable World. It's about war and alternatives to war. He wrote the March and April cover stories for Harper's Magazine. You quote President Bush from his 2002 State of the Union address when he said that the United States will not permit the world's most dangerous regimes to threaten us with the world's most destructive weapons. And you go on to say that if the United States followed through on that logic, it would become a disarmament empire. What do you mean by that expression?
Well, down to the present, the United States and other countries have sought to deal with the problem of the proliferation of nuclear arms and other weapons of mass destruction by diplomatic means. And in fact, under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, which is really a kind of masterpiece of diplomacy, you actually have 182 nations that have agreed to do without nuclear arms altogether. It's quite an accomplishment. Now, the Bush administration has really reversed that policy, and it said, we're going to deal with weapons of mass destruction, not with diplomacy, not with agreements, as all other presidents have done. We're going to do it by force, by preemption, by regime change, and that is what we have begun to do in Iraq, and that is what we are threatening to do to maybe Syria, Iran, North Korea, and on and on.
But you could argue that the Bush administration is only doing this or thinking of doing this with countries that either are nullifying their treaties or not signing the treaties in the first place.
Well,
that the treaties aren't working in these cases. So it's not instead of dealing with treaties, it's as an alternative when the treaties don't work.
Well, you could argue that, but you have to bear in mind that under the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, nations have a right to give notice of withdrawal. So actually, there is no country that is simply compelled to remain part of that treaty. And let's notice that in North Korea, they have given notice of withdrawal. So what the United States has really done is to say, we are going to establish a double standard for the world in which the existing nuclear powers, very much including the United States, can have our chosen weapons of mass destruction, that is nuclear weapons, and other countries that don't yet have them, whether in or out of the treaty, are forbidden from doing so, and we will go to war to prevent them from getting them. So it's a kind of war to preserve a double standard. I don't think it's tenable.
The argument on the other side would be that the United States is democracy, and we can be trusted to use nuclear weapons only if they were used against us, only if the lives of many Americans were were threatened, whereas there are a lot of rogue states with tyrants or psychopathic tyrants who have nuclear weapons and could use them for use them you know at will without the kind of serious deliberation that the United States would go through. I mean, look at how long the United States has had nuclear weapons, and it only used it at the end of the of World War II.
Well, Terry, what you have to bear in mind there is that actually it is not the policy of the United States to use nuclear weapons only when attacked by them or by something else. We actually have put forward, and in a new and more radical form under the Bush administration, a doctrine of first use and even preemptive use of nuclear weapons. And in fact, before the Iraq War began, Andrew Card, the president's chief of staff, went on television and said that if the Iraqis were to use chemical or biological weapons, that we reserved the right to use any means necessary, which is diplomacy for nuclear weapons, against them. And we actually have a new targeting directorate out there at Stratcom in Omaha that is right at this minute defining and seeking out those targets. And on top of that, we're seeking to develop new weapons, new nuclear weapons, these so-called bunker busters, which are capable of knocking out various underground installations in a first nuclear strike. So actually, our nuclear posture has never been more aggressive or preemptive, if you like, than it is now. So that trust might be misplaced, especially if you consider what our policy is.
Jonathan Schell is the author of the new book, The Unconquerable World. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. From the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by the National Endowment for the Arts, this is NPR, National Public Radio. Coming up, Alternatives to Military Force. We continue our conversation with Jonathan Schell, author of The Unconquerable World. Also, Jeff Nunberg on the language wars.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Jonathan Schell. His new book, The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People, is about alternatives to war. Schell wrote the cover stories for the March and April editions of Harper's Magazine on the futility of war. He's the peace and disarmament correspondent for The Nation and has written for The New Yorker and The Atlantic. His best-known book, The Fate of the Earth, was about the likely consequences of a nuclear war. Looking back over the history of attempts to keep the international peace, do you think that the war in Iraq is going to be seen in retrospect as a landmark event in the history of the United Nations, as a kind of vote of no confidence in the United Nations because the war happened in spite of the fact that the majority of countries on the Security Council would have voted against it had it come to the Security Council for a second vote?
Very clearly it is. In other words, the Bush administration has said in no uncertain terms that the United Nations had to vote in one way in order to be, as they said, relevant, and that was with the United States. So when the United States, overriding what was the clear will, as you say, of the Security Council, and went to war anyway, that was a watershed in the history of the institution. I don't have a crystal ball. It's very, very hard now to see how we're going to get back to a functioning United Nations. I mean, it was always a question how well it functioned anyway, but it was a hope, it was a basis, and now it's clearly suffered a grievous blow. And in fact, if you read some of the apologists for the administration, that was part of the point of the exercise. They do not want a multilateral cooperative world in which the United States depends on other nations for permissions to use force. They want a unilateral hegemonic world in which the United States has military superiority and is free to use its forces in any way and at any time it so chooses.
You are very critical of how the United States is using its power now in the post-Cold War world. You think the United States is being a bully. Do you have an alternate way for how you'd like to see the United States use its power now that it's the only superpower in the world?
Absolutely. I happen to think that there are real choices in history. In other words, that sometimes there can be a path to hell, and a path not, I would say, to heaven, because I don't believe in heaven on earth, but to something a little better than what we have now. And I think that we are at such a moment. I think the United States has made an epic wrong choice in seeking to rely principally on its overwhelming military force to have its way in the world. I think that's going to be a disaster for the world and for us. I think it's going to literally blow up in our faces. I think it's going to cause the very problems that it seeks to solve. Now, on the other hand, I do think that there is a path open to us that is one of remarkable promise. You know, I think that we're living at the first time, certainly in the modern period, certainly for the last 200 or 300 years, I don't know how far you want to go back, but it's the first time that all of the greater powers in the world, I mean Japan, Russia, Europe, United States, and so forth, are very much on the same page ideologically, or philosophically, for want of a better word. There's no ideological or religious division, let's say, of the kind that previously separated those powers. So from my point of view, this quarrel that has arisen over the Iraq war was an entirely unnecessary and self-inflicted wound that has led us to forego a marvelous opportunity to enter into cooperation with other powers and with lesser powers on Earth, who would be very happy to go along with this, to get down to business and solve the terrible global problems that we all face together. Because we don't have the kind of division in the world that we had previously. So, and those problems, I think, you know, are the obvious ones. It's keeping the global economy running. It's creating greater justice globally and nationally. It's dealing with environmental problems. But the United States, tragically, has withdrawn from all of that, has said no to the treaties, no to the environmental treaty, the Kyoto Accord, to the International Court, and so on and so forth, and decided to go alone on this military path. So I'd like to see us make a U-turn and get back to a path that's more consistent with our principles as a constitutional democracy and republic here at home, and start acting in a cooperative way with the rest of the world. I think there's tremendous promise in that path.
My guest is Jonathan Schell. His new book is called The Unconquerable World. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Jonathan Schell, and his new book is called The Unconquerable World, Power, Nonviolence, and the Will of the People. You know, we've talked about the United Nations and the League of Nations and their attempts to keep world peace. You kind of float the idea in your new book, The Unconquerable World, for a democratic league. What's your vision?
Well, you know, many people have pointed out the democracies, I mean constitutional democracies, liberal democracies, what have you, are less likely, way less likely, to go to war with one another than authoritarian or totalitarian regimes. And there are reasons for that, because I think liberal democracy really is a kind of system at home that tries to conduct your political affairs without egregious use of force, without coup d'etats and so forth. And so it's very natural to extend that to the international sphere. Now, tragically, we have to just face right up to the fact that those same liberal democracies historically have been imperial powers, instigators of war, of domination, of conquest in the world. We saw that in the 19th century. And now we see that same tendency arising in the present moment in the United States. But if we could forego and suppress and check our imperial tendency and get back to our constitutional bent, which runs very deep in the United States as well as in Europe and in other parts of the world, then I think there's a chance that we, again, have never had before to move towards very radical goals, such as peace in the world, by incremental means without having to do what failed so miserably for Wilson, namely to build up a gigantic structure such as the League of Nations or to something that, you know, would be like the United Nations or a replacement of it or what have you. I think we can, there's tremendous room for progress on an incremental basis.
How would that happen? How would that progress?
Well, it's in a certain way, it's modest stuff, although some of it is quite dramatic. For instance, I think at the very heart of it, you'd want to have an agreement. Actually, we already have it. It's called the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. But you would observe the agreement to move away altogether from weapons of mass destruction. And that means that you wouldn't be only trying to prevent new countries from getting them. You would have an agreement among the existing countries that have them to move gradually with inspections galore, with enforcement. Let it take 10 years, 15 years, whatever it would take, to get out of that business altogether. This would be an immeasurable step towards the safety of the world. And I'm afraid that without such a commitment, we're not going to be able to stop proliferation because I don't think we can enforce that double standard. I think the price of being safe from weapons of mass destruction is to give up your own.
You're suggesting the United States give up its nuclear weapons?
Together with the other nuclear powers, yes. They are actually committed to do so under the terms of the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty. We've committed ourselves to that repeatedly. It's just that we didn't mean it. I think the United States should propose that. Already we're on a path of reductions, but I think we should name zero as the goal and invite the other nuclear powers to join us in that commitment. And then on that basis, on that hugely strengthened basis, morally, politically, and even militarily strengthened basis, I would argue, to go before the world and say, we will not permit any other countries to get into this business that we were getting out of. And then I think we could really make some progress.
Outside of being able to claim the moral high ground, what's the difference whether the United States has nuclear weapons or doesn't have nuclear weapons when it says we're going to stop other countries from having weapons of mass destruction?
You know, you can't distinguish in this case between the moral and the practical. You know, the lesson of history is that countries get nuclear weapons because they fear nuclear weapons in the hands of the other. That's why the U.S. did it, because it was afraid that Hitler would get it. Soviet Union, China got it because the U.S. had it. India and Pakistan got it because they were afraid of one another, and India was afraid of China, and so forth. So that's the way it goes. So it's the practical consequence of possessing them is that you terrify other countries. They, too, want to be safe in this world. And the United States and the other nuclear powers, too, have, in every single action they've taken in the whole nuclear age, have taught a single lesson. And that is, if you want to be safe from nuclear weapons in the hands of others, get some for yourself. And as long as this is our operative lesson, we're going to have proliferation.
Looking back on the past few months, what do you think have been the strengths and the weaknesses of the international peace movement?
You know, a couple of months before the war broke out, there was almost no international peace movement. It was very, very hard to spot one. And then in one of those sort of gales of political concern and action that will occur from time to time, you saw what was really a kind of a miraculous rise all over the world of a very vigorous and active peace movement, which I think is going to be hugely important for the future, even though it failed actually to stop the war. Obviously, the war in Iraq, or at least the conventional part of it, is over, although I'm not clear at all what the future is going to be there, because that's an unwritten chapter of history. But here in the United States, I think we need to try to... The goal of a peace movement should be to pull us back from this hegemonic imperial path. In fact, there's a precedent that I think could be very useful. There was something at the turn of the century called the Anti-Imperial League. There were all kinds of distinguished people who belonged to it, including William James, Grover Cleveland, Carnegie, all kinds of university presidents. Mark Twain was a member. A very strong, powerful, well-connected political movement whose theme was, let's not become an imperial power in the world of the kind that we rebelled against back in our revolution. Let's be a constitutional republic and deal cooperatively with the world. It was a very strong movement, and I think that something like that should be the focus of the peace movement at this time. Maybe we should refound the Anti-Imperialist League, Anti-Imperial League, rather.
You've said that although you're a strong advocate of world peace, you're not a pacifist.
No, I'm not.
How do you know?
I know because as soon as I say to myself that I'm a pacifist, either I or someone else can start inventing 500 different situations in which I would either favor the use of force or I myself would use it. You know, the problem with that word for me is not its root, pax, which is, I think, a wonderful foundation for vigorous and very effective action in this world. The problem is the suffix ist, which suggests that this one rule suffices for all human situations. And when I examine myself, I just find that I don't think so.
Since you prefer nonviolence to violence in solving problems, are there examples from recent history where you think that there were nonviolent solutions to political problems that likely would have ended in war?
Yes, indeed. You know, I mentioned People's War and the discovery that people with inferior military force could defeat great empires. Well, some people had the wit to ask, would it be possible to defeat great empires without any force at all? One of the most beautiful examples of that was the Solidarity movement in Poland, rebelling against the communist regime there and eventually against the whole Soviet empire. Where is the Soviet empire now? They had a collection of weapons in their hands, such as no one has almost ever had before, from the nuclear weapon to the Red Army to the KGB, exerting control in every department of life there under that totalitarian regime. And yet it proved possible to bring them low, as Lech Wałęsa said in a beautiful boast, without breaking a single pane of glass. Now, I don't think we've absorbed the lesson of that incredible triumph of nonviolence. And when you look back at it, in the first half of the 20th century, it was a nonviolent rebellion by Mahatma Gandhi that was the specific instrument that brought down the British Empire, the greatest empire of its time. So down somewhere at the bottom of these hopeful possibilities that I see, if only we could get off this path of force, is this marvelous discovery during the 20th century that there is a way of exerting tremendous power, of making things happen in this world, of winning, that does not involve the use of force.
I'm guessing here, but I would bet that the phrase that you hear the most from critics of your political books is, you're naive. You're naive about the possible end of nuclear weapons. You're naive about international peace breaking out. You're naive that we can keep peace without the threat and the use of force. Do you hear that all the time, that you're naive? And if you do, what's your answer?
You know, I do hear it from time to time, quite honestly. In my own opinion, I am an arch realist. You know, there are two kinds of realism. One is the idea that force is sort of an ideology of force, that force always prevails. There's another kind of realism that says, let's look at what happened historically and take our cue from that. Now, I mentioned the collapse of the Soviet Union. How was that accounted for by a philosophy that says that force is always the final arbiter? Does the United States rule Vietnam today? No. All our military power was negated. Does the Soviet Union rule in Afghanistan? No. Is there a Soviet Union? No. Again and again, in the Philippines, a nonviolent movement kicked out the dictatorship. We saw dictatorships in Spain, in Greece, and 10 other countries that I could mention that I won't, that were dictatorships thrown out of power by entirely nonviolent movements. Now, those are realities. If you don't see them, you're not living in the real world. You have to grant force its scope. You have to come to terms with it. You have to see what it can do and what you can't do. But if you see only force and you shut out all the rest, you're indulging in what George Kennan called the naivete of realism. If the two greatest empires in the 20th century can be brought down without violence, you have to take that into account. If you don't, you're not living in the real world.
Well, Jonathan Schell, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thank you so much, Terry.
Jonathan Schell is the author of the new book, The Unconquerable World. Coming up, linguist Jeff Nunberg on the international language wars. This is Fresh Air. The movement to rename French fries Freedom Fries has been met by a response from some German professors who want to replace a lot of the English words that Germans use. But there are some interesting differences between the way the Europeans and the Americans go about this kind of linguistic patriotism, as our linguist Jeff Nunberg explains.
Turnabout is fair play. Last week, a couple of German university professors announced a campaign to eliminate a number of English language words that are popular in Germany in favor of their French equivalents. Germans were urged to replace date by rendezvous, playboy by bon vivant, and cool by formidable. Even the ubiquitous OK is on the hit list. From now on, Germans are supposed to say d'accord. Ich bin d'accord, du bist d'accord. There's no chance that any of this will catch on. No more than freedom fries and freedom toast are going to take up permanent residence in our speech. But then, these language wars are really intended as symbolic exercises. And unlike other kinds of trade actions, linguistic boycotts are always for the benefit of a domestic audience. After all, it's no skin off our nose what words the Germans use or vice versa. Who knew they were saying playboy in the first place? For those German professors, the object of the campaign is to reproach the local Americaphiles who have left the German language strewn with English words. But they want to do that without recalling the linguistic nationalists of the early Nazi period who wanted to purify the language of all foreign elements. German has perfectly good words of its own for notions like okay and date, but adopting the French equivalents makes it clear that the point is to demonstrate solidarity, not chauvinism. But the German approach isn't really appropriate for us. Not that English doesn't have thousands of words of French origin. In fact, when I looked at the list of English language words that the Germans were proposing to replace with French ones, it turns out that more than half of them were originally from French themselves, from date and tour to couch and model. But nobody registers those now as anything but native English stock. And when you look at the more recent borrowings that we still recognize as having a French origin, they turn out to be unsuitable for patriotic renaming, too. It's hard to imagine the House Republicans vowing to replace blasé by kicked back, or tête-à-tête by meeting. And the congressional cafeteria wasn't about to rebaptize pâté as freedom meatloaf, or quiche Lorraine as patriot custard. What kind of fare is that to serve in a U.S. government dining room? In that sense, this is very different from the frenzy of renaming during the First World War, when sauerkraut became Liberty Cabbage and hamburgers became Salisbury Steaks. Germans were a sizable presence in America back then, and renaming their dishes was a way of purging the signs of their foreignness. But this time around, we took a very different tack. We decided to replace the English word French with another English word, freedom. Of course, WAGS had a high time with that, pointing out the absurdity of freedom horn or freedom doors, not to mention freedom kiss. That phrase comes up 7,000 times on Google, an indication of how all smart alecks think alike. What made the business seem even more ridiculous to critics was that French fries aren't even French in origin. They come from Belgium. Heck, we don't even capitalize the F anymore. But then, this isn't so much about the French as about Frenchness, particularly the insidious Frenchness that works its way into our language and our culture and saps our sense of national purpose. This has less to do with them than with us. That might explain why the boycotters have generally given the other Europeans a free pass in all this. In the last 2 months' newspapers, boycott shows up near French 20 times as often as it does near German. To judge from the stories on TV, nobody's pouring Schloss Johannesberger into the gutter along with the bottles of Chateau Lafite. Actually, I noticed that the footage always shows the bottles already open before they're poured out, and I can't help but wonder whether, well, never mind, that's what I do too. For that matter, this would also explain why patriots aren't crushing bottles of Allegra pills, pouring out containers of Danone yogurt, or tearing up copies of Woman's Day and Car and Driver. True, most people aren't aware that those products are made by French-owned companies. But even if they were, they wouldn't care. The products may be French, but they aren't Gallic. Crushing a bottle of Allegra isn't going to get a rise out of the Sauternes-sipping, Roquefort-sniffing intellectuals and movie stars who took the French side when the war was being debated. I suspect that's why all those congressmen and restaurant owners seized on French fries for renaming. Of course they know that French fries aren't French, but that's the point. The gesture was so patently irrelevant and irrational that it was certain to drive the administration's critics up a wall. And maybe that's why the France bashing is still going on hot and heavy, even now that the war is a, if you'll excuse the expression, fait accompli. France may be irrelevant now, but some people still have a score to settle with Hollywood.
Jeff Nunberg is a linguist at Stanford and the author of The Way We Talk Now. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross. We'll close with a recording by the tenor saxophonist Teddy Edwards. He died Sunday at the age of 78. This is his 1960 recording of What's New.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Bantam Books, a division of Random House, publisher of Einstein in Berlin, a biography of Einstein's years in Germany from 1914 to 1932 by Thomas Levinson. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, John Brady Kiesling, the former U.S. diplomat who resigned in protest over the war in Iraq. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.